The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
In any White House, as Baker knew, the key to the kingdom is controlling the paperwork, controlling the personnel, controlling the press, controlling the legislative affairs. Policy is all great, but if you don't control the legislative affairs that gets policy passed, it's pretty irrelevant. And so Baker basically sat down, they drafted one piece of paper, we've got it in the book, in which, you know, on one column is what Baker gets, another column is what Meese gets. He throws in the cabinet rank as kind of a sweetener, and then he says, look, let's put this also in there. I'll never be in the Oval Office. There'll never be any meeting in the Oval Office in which you, Ed Meese, will not be entitled to come in. You'll be entitled to go. Any meeting you want to that the president is okay with you come in. Hey, that sounds great. And I'll just say the same for me. And by doing so, what Baker had managed to do was guarantee that he would never be excluded himself from the meetings that he needed to be in.
I'm David Priest, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, September 29th, 2020. James A. Baker III has been a lawyer, a presidential campaign manager, the White House chief of staff for two presidents, the Secretary of the Treasury, Secretary of State, and the point person for George W. Bush in the 2000 Florida recount. His career demonstrates what it takes to acquire political power, to wield it effectively, to reach bipartisan compromises even after bitter campaigns, and to wrestle with the tension between partisan loyalty and the principles of good government. I spoke about Baker's remarkable life and career with the incomparable team of Peter Baker of the New York Times and Susan Glasser of the New Yorker, authors of the new book, The Man Who Ran Washington, The Life and Times of James A. Baker III. It's the Lawfare Podcast, September 29th. Peter Baker and Susan Glasser on The Man Who Ran Washington. Peter and Susan, let's start with Jim Baker moving from his corporate law world. He'd been practicing in Texas, I think, for about a decade before moving to Washington. And within a year of that move, suddenly he's the de facto deputy of a cabinet department. And soon thereafter, the president's delegate hunter in 1976, and then his campaign head. How did Jim Baker get from working at a law firm to being one of the most powerful men in Washington in that short period of time?
Well, thank you, first of all, David. We're big fans of Lawfare and delighted to be with you today. You know, Peter and I have spent a lot of time marveling over that very question. Sitting here in Washington, we all know that it is extremely unusual, if not wholly unprecedented, for someone to be running the campaign of the incumbent president of the United States within essentially a year of arriving in DC. You know, we studied Jim Baker in part to answer that question. I think we did come to conclude that his might be actually the most successful midlife career change ever, really, or certainly in recent American history. But it's really a function, I think, of the neutron bomb-like effect of the Watergate scandal on Washington and the Republican Party. The Richard Nixon administration was essentially decimated by the fallout from the scandal. And that left an opportunity for people like Jim Baker, people like Dick Cheney, people like Donald Rumsfeld to rise to extraordinary positions of power in a short amount of time that they might not otherwise have been able to.
So really an odd combination of skill and luck. Jim Baker brought the goods, that is, he could actually deliver, and people recognized that early, but the Republican Party was decimated by anyone who had been closely associated with the embattled and then resigned president. So he appeared at the right time, huh?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, that's a story, obviously, of a lot of successful people, right? Managing to make the most of opportunities with the skill set you bring to the table. Baker, you know, just happened to do it better than most. And he happened to, you know, continue to impress the people who decided they needed his services, right? It's remarkable how it's not just his friend Bush from the campaign trail, but again, as Susan said, like an incumbent president of the United States very quickly recognized that this is somebody who was a mover and shaker. In fact, he was given the nickname the Miracle Man at the 1976 convention because they had managed to stave off Ronald Reagan, who was challenging Ford in what would be the last contested nominating convention, you know, in history. And so here's this guy who had never done it before, suddenly cadging Democrats, or delegates, excuse me, and trying to, you know, convince them to stand by a president who wasn't all that popular with the conservatives and pulled it off.
Sure. And how did he do that? Because we're going to talk later throughout the career that you chronicle here about how he applied his particular skills and approach to problems across a wide variety of places. But what was his skill set? How did he get by this point to be so good at doing things like that, even in a new domain?
Well, you know, it's interesting. In a way, he took that meticulousness of a corporate lawyer, and also this was beat into him by his family. It's a very interesting life story, actually. It comes from essentially three generations of Houston aristocracy, and his family was very wary of politics, but really drummed into him the requirements for meticulous preparation. He used to talk endlessly, if you ask his children or those who worked with him, about the five P's: prior preparation prevents poor performance. Now, of course, Washington, as you know, is filled with corporate lawyers who work really hard return every phone call. So it's not in and of itself a guarantee of success. But interestingly, Baker seemed to apply that plus his fanatic competitiveness learned on the tennis courts of the Houston Country Club with his partner, George H.W. Bush. He did apply those two attributes, certainly, to the challenge of managing the convention floor fight for Gerry Ford. The other thing is, he really learned something about managing the press and managing expectations, which would go with him throughout his career in Washington. The Reagan people were essentially BSing the journalists about how they were going to win and what their actual numbers were. Well, it turned out that Baker decided early on lying to the press was not a good idea. And he got a reputation for being really on the mark and saying, no, here's what our actual delegate headcount is. Mm-hmm. And it matched up a lot better than the Reagan teams.
I think the other thing, by the way, is as a good lawyer, right, a good lawyer understands what the person on the other side of the table needs in order to go away successful, figures out, and then that lawyer figures out what he can, you know, get out of him, right? What are the red lines of this person? And so as a delegate hunter, he would talk to you, what do you need? You know, you need a visit in the Oval Office, you need a phone call from the president. Hey, I got a seat at a state dinner. He was willing to do, you know, a lot to get these Republican delegates on board using the power and the incumbency of the White House. There were lines beyond which he wouldn't go. I mean, there were some people who asked for some pretty ridiculous things, but, you know, one guy asked him to fix his local sewer problem back in their hometown, that kind of thing. But Baker would try to figure out, just, I think this would be true throughout his career, what the other person needed and how to get it to him in order to get what he needed.
Okay, so he comes to Washington. He has meteoric success. He, of course, fails in the campaign of 1976, but right after Watergate somehow gets the Republican presidential candidate within just a hair's length of victory. And he's picked up all this experience, both in terms of Washington politics and dealing with the press. So it makes sense that he goes back to Texas and runs for office. I believe he ran for attorney general in 1978. And it did not go well. Why? What didn't translate here?
This was not a man who was made for kissing babies and shaking hands of random voters at street fairs.
He could do it with foreign ministers and treasury secretaries and politicians, but not retail politics, huh?
Well, that's right. Listening to the, you know, members of the Bush family talk about their friend Jim Baker and how bad he was at retail politics was really something. And of course, frankly, had he won, his life would have been very different and he never would have had the extraordinary success that we associate with him. He would not have become the Secretary of State who ended the Cold War. He would not have become the White House Chief of Staff. So in a way, it was a very, very fortuitous case of a man failing to find his calling.
Now, he failed in that bid, but he wasn't done with electoral politics. He was just done with it from his own point of view. He certainly went back into the game relatively quickly. In fact, almost overnight, he started running the George H.W. Bush campaign for what would be the election in 1980. Now, as that campaign started, people don't remember it now, but it ended up being not quite a horse race, but getting pretty close between Ronald Reagan and George H.W. Bush. It didn't start that way. In fact, there was so little support for Bush 41 that he only had an asterisk in the polls early on among the Republican field. How did Jim Baker help take that campaign, a very inauspicious beginning, and take it to the point where George H.W. Bush earned the respect of Ronald Reagan enough to be named his vice presidential nominee?
Well, that's right, exactly. In fact, they had buttons made up that said the Asterisk Club, so that people who were working on the campaign were all part of the Asterisk Club. And I think they made a virtue out of this in a way. You know, what Baker did was study what worked in 1976 for Jimmy Carter. And Jimmy Carter had basically pioneered a new way of running for the presidency, which is to go to Iowa, the first caucus state, and just plant yourself there. Just stay there until people got to know you. And that's what Bush did. That's what Bush did under Baker's, you know, leadership. And Bush then surprised Reagan, came out of nowhere basically, and beat Reagan, who was at that point the colossus of the party, at the Iowa caucus. That gave him what Bush famously called the Big Mo, meaning momentum. Now, they didn't keep it going, obviously. Reagan had too many built-in advantages. He was the darling of the right. He was the man in the moment. People in the Republican Party were crying out for somebody like Reagan. And Bush, by contrast, was seen as a little too moderate, a little too establishment, a little too, you know, restrained. But Baker helped him put on a really strong showing. And by doing so, helped him get on the ticket. The most important thing Baker did was tell him to drop out. That was something that a lot of candidates just don't know when to do. And you need to have a friend you trust who is your peer who can tell you, it's over now. You have to get out. And if they had not gotten out when Baker basically forced Bush to do so, he might not have been able to convince Reagan to put him on the ticket. The bitterness might have been too strong. It might have blown up what ended up being a pretty important partnership.
And that leaves us with a situation that, let's take the names out of it, and I'll describe this scenario. You have the Republican nominee now who has faced a relatively strong challenge from someone who has been out there saying things like the lead nominee's economic plan is voodoo economics, essentially referring to that other candidate's, maybe his age being an issue in the campaign, perhaps saying that he's too radical to be the nominee. Eventually, electoral politics take over, and that nominee selects that challenger to be the vice presidential nominee. But in a case like that, it's really easy for the nominee, and perhaps the nominee's wife, to blame the campaign manager, the person who put that nice man George up to all of this. And yet, somehow, the campaign manager for the opponent ends up as the ultimate president's chief of staff. How did Jim Baker make that transition and earn the trust of Ronald Reagan so that he would actually come in to be chief of staff instead of one of Reagan's own long trusted advisors?
You know, this really was the key moment, in a way, the breakthrough moment for Jim Baker. And interestingly, it comes out of two different things. One is that incredible dysfunction around Reagan himself and his inner circle, mm-hmm. and the fact that some of his key lieutenants, in particular, Mike Deaver and Stuart Spencer, were aware that it could be disastrous for Reagan to run the White House the way that things had been going on the campaign, or even with some of the people who had helped him run the state of California when he was governor, in particular Ed Meese, who was considered essentially sort of, you know, that Charlie Brown cartoon with the, you know, the character with the kind of dirt flying all around.
Pigpen.
Like, you know, like basically, like, I think Ed Meese was where paperwork went to die. Yeah. You know, so you didn't really want him.
Yeah, the joke was if a piece of paper went into his briefcase, it never came back out.
So you didn't want him to be the White House chief of staff. So partially it's the intrigue from Reagan World itself, right? So they're looking for somebody else. And then there's Baker's own sort of remarkable record of coming essentially from nowhere, running the Ford campaign, and then running Bush's quite overperforming campaign in 1980 in the primaries. And so that record, he had gotten to know the Reagan people, had been impressed with him and had even reached out to him during that 1978 attorney general race. He had gotten Reagan to help him fundraise, clearly with an eye towards 1980. So he was on their radar screen already. Interestingly, to your point about, you know, how do you accomplish this bashing Reagan to helping Reagan win transition, Baker was very conscious of the strategic objective that he had of getting George H.W. Bush on the ticket as a vice presidential nominee. I mean, and they obviously saw pretty early on that he wasn't going to win and become the presidential nominee. And so Baker was very worried when Bush during the campaign was bashing Reagan, and the voodoo economics thing in particular. There's some really interesting back and forth and correspondence within the campaign, because Baker knew that if you overdid it, you were going to risk getting that spot on the ticket.
Let's take a look at a few slices of Jim Baker's work as chief of staff, because it's fascinating to see this combination of skill, experience, and basically learning the game of the politics inside a, in many ways, dysfunctional White House. First, let's look at a key relationship you mentioned, Peter, which is the Ed Meese side of things. Ed Meese coming in, sure looks like he could be chief of staff based on his experience with Reagan, but just doesn't have the skills to be an effective chief of staff. Jim Baker recognizes this, recognizes that Meese is going to be a competitor in some ways for access to the president, but realizes he can't take him head on and remove him because Reagan is just too much of a softie to make his old friend go away. So how did Jim Baker, the lawyer, approach this from day one to make sure that he and Meese would be able to work together even as Baker started to accumulate power?
Yeah, it's a great question. In fact, I also one of the key moments as well. I think from the very beginning, he determined to make Meese, if not his partner, at least to defang him to some extent. So that he sat down with Meese and said, let's just figure out how to divide up power, basically. They had what would be called a power sharing agreement, in which he said Meese is going to be the counselor. They came up with that title. The Deaver folks came up with that title as a way of placating Meese, who was very upset that he wasn't going to be the chief of staff. And Baker came up with the idea of saying, hey, you'll actually have cabinet rank, and you'll be in charge of all these policy councils, and you'll be in charge of this and that. I'll just take care of the press and the legislative stuff.
And the paperwork going into the Oval Office, just something small like that.
Well, guess what? In any White House, as Baker knew, that's the key to the kingdom. The key to the kingdom is controlling the paperwork, controlling the personnel, controlling the press, controlling the legislative affairs. Policy is all great, but if you don't control the legislative affairs that gets policy passed, it's pretty irrelevant. And so Baker basically sat down, they drafted one piece of paper, we've got it in the book, in which, you know, on one column is what Baker gets, another column is what Meese gets. Then he throws in the cabinet rank as kind of a sweetener. And then he says, look, let's put this also in there. I'll never be in the Oval Office. There'll never be any meeting in the Oval Office in which you, Ed Meese, will not be entitled to come in. Mm-hmm. You'll be entitled to go any meeting that you want to that the president is okay with you come in. Hey, that sounds great. And I'll just say the same for me. And by doing so, what Baker had managed to do was guarantee that he would never be excluded himself from the meetings that he needed to be in. And so it was a very clever way of working at Meese at the same time while guaranteeing his own power.
Well, and in fact, that is still studied to this day as the sort of the gold standard for, you know, how to sort of bureaucratically defeat an opponent. The one other thing that he put in there that was, I think, very significant was in the White House, as you know, real estate is also a form of power. Mm-hmm. You got the White House Chief of Staff's office historically. And that meant that even if there was going to be a different division of labor, he knew that everyone who worked in the White House would see him as the guy who was the final stop and who was the last word on things, because that's historically where it was. And of course, it's also a question of proximity. In Washington, if you have direct access at any time to the boss and you have the office that gets you there, essentially you've got what you need.
And it led to a real oddity, of course, because Meese wanting status and the appearance of status. Oh, he has cabinet rank, which sounds great, doesn't mean much, but he also gets a nice office nearby. somebody's got to go. And it led to that historical oddity of the National Security Advisor operating out of an office downstairs, not next to the president.
Exactly.
Which I think says a lot about the Baker-Meese relationship and how they managed it.
Exactly. Meese got Henry Kissinger's old corner office in the West Wing on the same floor as the Oval Office. That was a big deal. Mm-hmm. The other thing was that, you know, I have to say I went and interviewed Ed Meese for this book. And one thing I asked him about this, why did you decide to agree? He mentioned the cabinet rank even then. So all these years later, it was still important to him that he had cabinet rank. That just shows how
about that?
Right. It shows what Baker understood about him. Baker understood what the guy at the other side of the table needed. He needed the stature, he needed the status, he needed the respect, and that came with cabinet rank.
By the way, this is a great life lesson, I would say, that applies not just to the White House, but to anyone who's listening in any life experience. And I saw this just even as an editor running various publications. The people who care about the title and the corner office, you know, not necessarily the people who are going to be your go-to indispensable work partners.
Let's fast forward a few weeks. And it really only was a matter of 2 or 3 months, so a matter of weeks. And Ronald Reagan is shot at the Washington Hilton. And Jim Baker has a role to play here because he gets to the hospital, starts talking with other senior advisors, and they decide not to push the vice president to invoke the 25th Amendment, which would allow the vice president to temporarily act as president while President Reagan is clearly incapacitated. Talk a little bit about why not? Why they didn't take the step that most historians look back at and say, that's exactly what the 25th Amendment was designed for. How did he play that out and why?
You know, it's interesting. You know, he described essentially doing this in a, you know, closet at the hospital, just on the spur of the moment. What's very interesting is that it shows, first of all, that Jim Baker really still had very much the political interests of his close friend, his best friend, really, George H.W. Bush, now the vice president, at heart. He knew that there was still a lot of wariness and concern about Bush within the sort of hardcore ideological circles of the Reagan Revolution. Both he and Bush were seen as representatives of the sort of hated country club Republican establishment. And the idea that he would be encroaching on Reagan's power, that he would be stepping in, even in a situation that would seem to be tailor-made for it, there was just a great fear and instinctive revulsion at this idea, and that it could hurt both Bush and also Baker as well, who was still a newcomer and an outsider to the Reagan inner circle and still jostling and jockeying for power.
And the truth is, it comes back to our previous comment about, you know, if you really think the title matters, it's probably not the right thing. Bush didn't need the title of acting president to be, in effect, the number one person in the room while Reagan was gone. He already had that. It was called the vice president. So in any cabinet meeting, any of these policy meetings, the vice president was already number one. He didn't need to have it formally verified. So they understood that it was better, as Susan said, to let that go by and demonstrate loyalty. In fact, Bush was out of town. He was in Texas when this happened. They called him. They could barely get through on the plane. It couldn't hear him. What's going on? Something's happening. And he gets himself back to Washington, and he flies on the helicopter back, not to the south lawn of the White House, which is where they want him to fly, to get there back immediately. But instead, he says, no, you have to go up to the vice president's mansion, the residence where he normally flies, the Naval Observatory up Massachusetts Avenue from the White House. And then he would take the motorcade back to the White House. He says, only the president lands on the south lawn. And that shows Bush's, by the way, Bush's intuitive understanding of Washington, because he did not want to look presumptive. And that simple act made him look like he was deferential to the president as he should be.
And by the way, right, look at the incredible contrast with Al Haig in the exact same moment, who, you know, goes to the White House briefing room, steps up to the podium, and essentially says, I'm in charge here. And, you know, is forever tarred decades later as a usurper or a wannabe usurper because of that action, in such contrast to the instincts and the immediate response of both Bush and Jim Baker.
Let's take just one other example of Jim Baker as White House Chief of Staff. One way you could phrase it is that Jim Baker was a preeminent source of information and insight for the Washington Press Corps. The other phrase for that is leaker. Yeah. And he was somebody who was consistently giving messages to the press, working the press, revealing things here and there. So by the fall of 1983, this had become a real problem in the White House. And the president authorized a leak investigation, including polygraph tests for everyone, including Baker. I want you to talk a little bit about the episode that occurred at the White House. Jim Baker finds out about it. He comes back to the White House in a rush, and he notices when he goes in to see Reagan, he sees two people in the room. He sees George H.W. Bush, the vice president, and he sees George Shultz, the Secretary of State, a man of great dignity and honor. What does Jim Baker do, and how does it change the dynamic of this leak investigation on the spot?
Yeah, it's really remarkable. He learns in a car on the way to lunch with his friend Mike Deaver at the Madison Hotel, and Deaver tells him this, and Baker says basically, what? And he makes the driver turn the car around immediately, yeah. Heads right back to the White House and heads into that meeting you're talking about where the president was having lunch with the vice president and secretary of state. And Baker just tells him, Mr. President, I can't believe you've done this, basically. And it's George Shultz who says, you know, Mr. President, you will strap me to a polygraph one time and one time only because I won't be secretary of state after that, if that happens. And it's that moment that Reagan, of course, backs down. And in doing so, of course, Baker, you know, rallies the allies who matter the most. You know, he says to the president, I don't think you can make a constitutional officer, meaning the vice president of the United States, take a polygraph. He's not an aide. He's not a staffer to you. He's a constitutionally elected officer. And Reagan hadn't thought it through. He had let himself be pushed into it by other staffers. And Baker had been for a moment outmaneuvered. And he, of course, then came back in and took charge because he just thought that it was a pernicious idea to sit there and start putting staffers on lie detector machines.
Well, but also because he did think it would negatively affect him. He had, in fact, spoken with the Washington Post reporter whose story was at issue here, who actually then issued a remarkably unusual statement in effect saying, yes, I did speak with Jim Baker for this story, but he didn't tell me anything inappropriate. And he only told me about the public part of it. The other thing is it speaks to Baker's instincts because he immediately read the room and, you know, obviously Bush is his friend and ally. And so was George Shultz, who in many of the internecine battles, which were vicious in the Reagan administration, Shultz and Baker were usually on the same side. So, you know, he felt probably confident that this was as good of a venue as any for pushing his advantage. And it really, it's a telling scene, though. Can you imagine him in the limousine about to get out at the Madison Hotel and have lunch, which, by the way, is the hotel that was right across the street from the old Washington Post newsroom. It's a Washington Post story that was the issue. And the Madison was essentially a canteen for Post editors and reporters, many of whom would have been there to observe Baker in the midst of this.
Then as Reagan's first term transitions into his second term, Baker engineers a job switch with Donald Reagan. What job did he get and why did he want it?
You know, Jim Baker was exhausted by being chief of staff and, in fact, had repeatedly tried to get out of the job earlier in the first term. And there's a great episode in the book we recount of how he came literally within 5 minutes of actually engineering a job switch only a couple years into the administration where he would become the national security advisor. That was foiled by his internal enemies and Ronald Reagan. So flash forward a couple years, Reagan wins re-election in a landslide in 1984. And what I like about this story is that the whole job switch in which Jim Baker ends up as Treasury Secretary starts with the incumbent Treasury Secretary being furious with him and calling him up on the phone and dropping a whole lot of F-bombs. And so it's a kind of a great Washington story.
About a leak, by the way.
That's right, about a leak.
He was mad about a leak.
He was mad about a leak. Don Regan was the Treasury Secretary at the time. And, you know, Baker fights his way through the F-bombs. They end up deciding to have lunch with each other to sort of kiss and make up. And when that happens, Regan basically volunteers that he's ready for a change. And, you know, at this point, Jim Baker, I don't think he had imagined himself as Secretary of the Treasury. This is a man who, after all, only had one undergraduate course in economics at Princeton to his name. He had no background in finance or Wall Street. And yet he saw this as a lifeline and he grabbed onto it and he engineered remarkably seamlessly this switch from staffer to principal in Washington terms. And he became very quickly the next Secretary of the Treasury.
Jim Baker loves the job as Treasury Secretary and does things like mastermind the Tax Reform Act of 1986, among other things. But he's reluctantly pulled away in August of 1988 to run the presidential campaign for his friend, George H.W. Bush. Now, on the one hand, this highlighted a real contrast in his career, because he would really push hard in a campaign, being ruthless, brutal as a campaign chairman, no holds barred campaigning. An example of that, of course, is this very campaign for Bush in 1988, where Al Gore had weaponized first the fact that a man named Willie Horton had been put out on a prison furlough by Michael Dukakis, the governor of Massachusetts, and then an independent group did the famous ad of the revolving doors of criminals in Massachusetts that was visibly racist. Jim Baker didn't run that ad personally, but he certainly didn't mind it. So on the one hand, somebody who knows that a campaign is a ruthless act. On the other hand, once in office, it was always about getting the deal done. He wanted to find a way that bipartisanship could get to real working solutions. So take a look at that tension and talk about that 1988 campaign and how it really broke apart that tension for Baker and ultimately did get Bush elected president.
Yeah, I think Baker was part of a generation that saw, and certainly he did, saw campaigns as sort of the dirty, sordid business you had to do in order to get to the place you wanted to be, which is to be in office and in order to govern, in order to actually get some things done. It's kind of the opposite today, where people look at being in office as a way of setting themselves up for the next campaign. Mm-hmm. But back then, he wanted to do something after winning. It wasn't enough that they had beaten Michael Dukakis if they didn't do anything with what they had earned. And so, yeah, right, he was willing to be as tough as nails during the campaign. They played it was a pretty rough campaign. You mentioned Willie Horton, but they also questioned Dukakis' patriotism. The flag and the Pledge of Allegiance and the ACLU, these are all parts of that campaign. But once it was over, you're right, Baker then sits down literally within weeks of the campaign being over. He sits down with Jim Wright. Jim Wright was the Democratic Speaker of the House of Representatives that time, because Baker wanted to do something important at the start of this next term, which is to get the Contra War off of George Bush's plate.
Right.
Contra War had almost destroyed the Reagan presidency because of the Iran-Contra scandal, which Baker had luckily managed to keep himself out of. But he had seen how Reagan had been debilitated by it, and Baker wanted to get it off the table. So he sat down with Jim Wright, and he sat down with Jimmy Carter, helped make a deal that basically made that go away. And he would do this at various points throughout his career. He would sit down with Democrats and cut bargains. That made him unpopular with conservatives. A lot of the Reaganites thought he was a sellout because he did stuff like that. In today's Washington, he definitely would be seen as a sellout. But in that era, when he had a divided government, he didn't see any choice. He said, if you want to get something done, you're going to have to sit down with the other side.
Well, the other thing is that it shows you how much the incentive system in our politics has changed so radically. In part, he wanted to get things done because he wanted to get things done, in part because that was the way to win. And that is no longer perceived to be the way to win. And, you know, it used to be that campaigns in the U.S. appealed to a broad middle, right? And there were actual swing voters as opposed to tiny, tiny, tiny sub-segments of some small demographic groups in some key battleground states. You know, we're talking about a world that he came up in which close to half of the U.S. states in the 1976 election were genuinely competitive in the presidential race.
Right.
Fast forward to 2012, where there was something like only 10 states that were competitive at all. And so you see that the incentive structure, even in an electoral sense, was for Jim Baker and George H.W. Bush to actually do things and to have not so much a narrow ideology that appealed to a fanatic minority, but a pretty broad-based centrist coalition was actually the way to win.
And let's look at some of how he translated that, what do you do once you've won, into reality as Secretary of State. Now, here's a man with no real diplomatic experience, no foreign language skills, and no interest in representing the Foreign Service to the president. He sees the relationship very differently, but of course, a very momentous 4 years for him to be Secretary of State. Let's look at some of these events, not to rehash the history of each, but focusing on Baker's role in them. First, how to deal with China after the events of Tiananmen Square, the importance of the relationship versus the importance of somehow punishing Beijing. Talk through Baker's role in that.
Well, basically, that's one of the ones where Baker takes a back seat because he recognizes the president, President Bush, who had been the envoy to Beijing back in the day, saw himself as what he called the desk officer for China. So Baker was happy to let Bush take the lead on that one. It really wasn't a winner from his point of view. As Susan puts it, he's all about winning, and he susses out which issues are possible to make some victories and which ones aren't. He didn't see a particularly beneficial field there in China, and he didn't, you know, but they also were not, they were upset by what happened in Tiananmen. They were offended by it, but it was a very real politique reaction. Their first real concern was how to not blow up the relationship with China. So they applied sanctions mostly to try to head off Congress. They cut off contacts mostly to retain their viability so they could later keep the relationship going. In fact, they had secret communications with China saying, look, you guys have to help us out here because we need to keep the relationship going, but you have to make some concessions. So that was a sort of a symbol of the way Baker looked at diplomacy. It wasn't driven by human rights. It wasn't driven by, some sort of sense of morality per se. It was driven by a very cold-hearted, cold-eyed pragmatism about what could be done and how to do it.
Yep. Let's look at another one. Getting the Panamanian dictator, Noriega, out of office. What was Jim Baker's role in that?
Well, there too, I think, in a way, he saw that as not really his agenda and a distraction. Because the incredible thing about the ouster of Manuel Noriega is that it came essentially a little bit more than a month after the fall of the Berlin Wall. And Baker was really all about being strategic, even to the point of ruthlessness, when he considered what his agenda should be as Secretary of State. And even though there were many, many things going on at this moment in the world, the years from 1989 to 1991 were some of the most consequential in recent history. And, so you had these events in South America, Latin America. You also had, the collapse finally of the apartheid regime in South Africa. Jim Baker didn't want to deal with that. He was also very allergic at the beginning of his tenure to the Middle East, for example. He just thought it was a quagmire and that if he couldn't make meaningful progress, he didn't want to deal with it. And I think that's probably how he felt about Panama to a certain extent. But there was a lot of domestic politics on it. But for Baker, at that moment in time, it was over Christmas 1989 and into 1990, Jim Baker was really focused on the implications of essentially the unraveling of the Soviet Empire in Eastern Europe and what was going to be the U.S., how could the U.S. play a leadership role? And by the way, that's the other thing that's so different from today. It was just unquestioned that from Baker and Bush's point of view, that they would be playing a leading role in midwifing and in negotiating the reunification of Germany and the creation of a new order in Europe. They just didn't know how.
Right. It wasn't arguments over whether America should lead. It was always about how America could lead most effectively.
Well, that's right. And how to do that without blowing up what at this time was an incredibly terrifying nuclear stand up with the Soviets, and a partner in Mikhail Gorbachev, and for Baker in Eduard Shevardnadze, the Soviet foreign minister, partners who appeared to be well-intentioned, but whose own political standing at home in a very opaque Soviet regime and system that we didn't quite understand. It wasn't clear, except that they were on shaky ground as reformers. And where was this going to end? Was this going to be the renovation of the Soviet system? Was it going to provoke a backlash at the ouster of Gorbachev and the imposition of a new hardline KGB-run dictatorship, which, by the way, as we all know, actually came very close to happening?
How important was Jim Baker's personal relationship with Eduard Shevardnadze, the foreign minister of the Soviet Union at the time?
I think this was a key event in the history of the unraveling of the Soviet Union. Shevardnadze from Georgia, from the country of Georgia, turned out to be possibly even more of an anti-Soviet reformer than Gorbachev himself. The two of them had gone way back in the Soviet system and had confided their questions about it to each other decades earlier. That was still largely unknown at the time. But Shevardnadze, Baker called him Chevy, and Baker bonded, including on a famous trip out to Wyoming, which is where Jim Baker has a ranch. It's in many ways, although he's a Texan, born and bred, in many ways, Wyoming is the country of his heart. And it meant something very significant for him to invite Shevardnadze on this bonding experience. They went fishing in Wyoming. And that relationship became the go-to relationship in trying to steady the world through a period of really breathtaking change.
Right. As the bridge between two important episodes, we of course have him working with the Soviet foreign minister on what became the unraveling of the Soviet Union. And a telling quote of what he told Shevardnadze at one point was, "We must find a solution where there won't be any winners and losers, but where everybody wins." And that really does seem to get to his philosophy in managing so many international crises. And of course, Shevardnadze plays a role with the resolution of the Iraqi invasion of Kuwait in a return for that visit to Wyoming. Baker had accepted an invitation from his counterpart to go fishing on the shores of Lake Baikal in the city of Irkutsk in what is now Russia. Talk a little bit about what Baker's added value was in the process of getting the coalition built, of managing the coalition, and ultimately successfully seeing the Iraqi withdrawal from Kuwait by force.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Look, what you quoted is exactly right. That how can we have everybody be a winner and not have anybody be a loser? That is so different from today's philosophy in Washington. You know, Baker didn't believe in zero-sum politics. He didn't believe for him to win, other people had to lose. What he believed was, how do we get to the place where everybody can walk away with something that they need, mm-hmm. and I get what I need especially. And that was borne out in that fishing trip in Irkutsk. Exactly right. They went fishing in Irkutsk on Lake Baikal, this beautiful, largest lake in the world. And that's when Saddam Hussein invades Kuwait. And it's because of that friendship that he's able to say to Shevardnadze, we should be standing together against this. And he flies back to Moscow, and the two of them stand together at the airport there, at Vnukovo Airport, and they issue the first time ever U.S.-Soviet statement saying, this is not right. This will not, this is against the rules of the international order. We combine the two superpowers who have been fighting in effect for 40 years, agree that Iraq has violated the new norms, this new world order. That would never have happened, I think, had there not been this forged relationship between Shevardnadze mm-hmm. and Baker. In fact, Shevardnadze took a real hit for doing it. He had to fight with his own military establishment just to put out that statement. He wouldn't have done it if he didn't have the trust and the relationship that he had built with Baker. So great forces of history were moving at that time. Baker didn't start them, but he helped manage them. And if it hadn't been, I think it does matter who is in charge at moments when history is on the move.
And I think it was telling that something he didn't want to touch early in his tenure as secretary, he ended up jumping into after the resolution of the Iraq-Kuwait crisis. He ended up translating the success in the Gulf War into a historic peace conference in Madrid, where Israelis and Palestinians sat in the same room and discussed issues in a forum that was public. How did Baker put this together?
Well, it is interesting how he was very hands-off about Middle East diplomacy at the beginning of his tenure and adamant even about it, rejecting. We have a copy of a memo that his aide sent him when he first became secretary, in which he underlined the words essentially, no way, I'm not doing this. And so he saw that the successful conclusion of the Gulf War would create an enormous amount of leverage and goodwill for the U.S. in the region, and he wanted to expend it before it dissipated on its own. And so even while the bombs were still flying in Iraq, he was plotting with his advisors on how he could turn this into an opening for Mideast peace. And I think both Peter and I came away from this viewing the Baker story as one that really tells you how history isn't as inevitable as it looks in hindsight. And this might not have happened, this peace conference, had Baker not personally thrown himself into it. The longest round, essentially, of shuttle diplomacy since Henry Kissinger in the 1970s. He was essentially just flying around on his plane constantly and cajoling and pushing and negotiating to get the Israelis, and not just the Palestinians, but the Arab countries to come to the same peace conference for the first time. And listening to his description, for example, of what it took to get Hafez al-Assad, the wily, brutal dictator of Syria next door from Israel, to agree to this. Hours and hours and hours of meetings. He called it bladder diplomacy because Assad, in his power play, would essentially ply Baker and the other diplomats with tea and never agree to get up or do anything for it, and just harangue them for hours. And of course, nobody wants to be the first person to give up in a situation like that. So it really was a relentless effort that was needed to convince these Arab countries to come to the table in Madrid with the Israelis in the same place.
And it seems that Baker really thought he had momentum to use a second Bush term to make true perhaps the ultimate progress on these Madrid talks towards Middle East peace. But of course, George Bush convinces him to come back to the White House in August 1992 to rescue his failing campaign. Perhaps like never since his failed 1978 bid at the Attorney General office in Texas, Baker seemed disengaged, not energetic, even depressed. Why do you think this was?
Well, he was just devastated at this turn of events. He did not want to go back to the White House. He did not want to go back to being an operative, a handler, a fixer. He had finally gotten himself the place where he was a statesman. He was an international statesman dealing with questions of war and peace. And suddenly now he was being called back to his first calling, which is to be a campaign guy. He didn't want to have to decide about questions about the balloons falling at a convention and, you know, who got which seats on the floor. That seemed beneath him. He literally was almost crying the day he left the State Department to go back to the White House. So you're right. When he got back to the White House, the campaign was on the downside anyway. They looked like they were losing. And people said to him, you know, his own aides came to him and said, "What are you doing? You're not doing this. I am too," he says. "No, you're not." And they even went to his wife and tried to get her to like pump him up again, get him going. And he just couldn't get engaged. And it may not have made a difference one way or the other. It was probably too late. Everybody was happy to have him back because he was seen as a, you know, the most effective campaign guy of his party, of his generation. But by the time he comes back, the die was probably cast and Bill Clinton is pulling out in front. It's a measure of Baker's stature at that point that George Bush at one of the debates says, "If I win re-election, I'm going to put Jim Baker in charge of the economy for the next 4 years." Baker's not at all happy about that. He wants to go back to doing the Middle East. But, it was sort of the credibility that he brought to the table. It just wasn't enough.
Often forgotten in this period is that the final independent counsel under the old statute was named on the eve of the expiration of that statute to investigate some activity at the State Department. What was under investigation and how was Baker involved?
Well, and who named the investigator? This is a really interesting story. So in the final weeks of the campaign, there's this conversation about whether or not Bill Clinton had tried to renounce his citizenship during the Vietnam War. It was a canard. It wasn't truth. There wasn't any truth to it. But in fact, actually, some Republican congressmen came to the Oval Office at one point and tried to get Bush to get the British and the Russians to help dig up dirt on Bill Clinton. Guess what? George Bush and Jim Baker said, "No, we don't ask the foreigners to help us in our domestic affairs." In fact, Jim Baker then writes a memo to the file, which we have, it's in the book, in which he said, "We said, no, we don't do that kind of thing." But there was some people at the State Department, and Jim Baker, of course, had encouraged us at first. He started looking through the passport file to expedite what were FOI requests, Freedom of Information requests by reporters for Bill Clinton's passport file. It took a couple hours, but Baker quickly realized it's a bad idea and then tried to shut it down and said, "Don't do it." But in the end, it did end up resulting in an independent counsel investigation, an independent counsel appointed by Bill Barr, who happened to be the Attorney General at the time. And that's somebody who will never be forgiven by Jim Baker and his staff, who then spent the next 2 or 3 years being investigated for what ended up turning out to be nothing.
And that's the real end to the story of that investigation and the independent counsel statute. Is it was what, the end of 1995 by the time that investigation finished. And I believe that the independent counsel, Joe DeGeneva, found there was nothing illegal, that perhaps some of the Baker team had acted stupidly, but I believe DeGeneva even went on to say that the Attorney General, Bill Barr, should never have sought his appointment in the first place.
Well, that's right. That's an unusual thing. You don't get a lot of investigators sending a note to their putative subject saying, "Sorry, we even looked into this." Mm-hmm. But, you know, of course, Baker is a very savvy student of Washington at this point. He understands that, you know, the allegation is the thing that people will remember, and the story about what happened to it years later in a different presidency is buried on the inside pages and it's not front page news anymore. So clearing your name is not easy. And the thing about Baker, right, is that he really valued his reputation for personal rectitude through a long career of, you know, really hardball politics. And this in part, I think, was his family legacy as well, because he came from a family, sort of almost Houston aristocracy, a family of lawyers who had helped to found and build many of the key institutions of what became modern Houston, they were very averse to politics. In fact, it was beaten into him from a young age that this is not a proper occupation for a gentleman. Mm-hmm. To be in politics. Had his father still been alive and at the height of his powers, Baker might never have come to Washington in the first place in the 1970s. Right. And I think for him, the idea that the family name would be sullied was something that he was really scared of from the very beginning of his time in politics and eager. That's why he kept these files, which mm-hmm. he still has to this day, all the inappropriate things that he was asked to do and he refused to do. This was not a guy who was going to come out of it with court cases and the like.
So we've got 8 years in the wilderness for Jim Baker. He's a Republican Party establishment at this point. He considers running for president in 1996, but declines. But we get to 2000, and he has not been a formal part of the George W. Bush campaign. But the morning after the election, he gets a call from the campaign to head to Florida and lead the team to defend Bush's popular vote victory there. Tell us, perhaps by contrast with the head of the Gore legal team there, former Secretary of State himself, Warren Christopher, how Baker got his old energy and skills back to manage this process in Florida.
Yeah, you know, Warren Christopher was well respected by everybody, but he was not the knife fighter that Jim Baker was. And the Democrats told us when we were researching this book that as soon as the Baker's appointment was announced, they knew they were in deep trouble and that probably would lose. So Baker shows up in Florida and they arrange a meeting with Warren Christopher, and he brings two of his aides. Christopher brings two of his. They sit down at the table, and Christopher's got all these ideas. You know, here's how we can go about resolving this issue. And if that one doesn't work, he's got a plan B. Well, Baker just says, look, Chris, I'm not here to negotiate. Governor Bush won. It's my job to make sure that that stays that way. And then Christopher goes to plan B, and Baker gives him the same answer, and plan C gives him the same answer. And suddenly a meeting that was expected to go for hours is over in 20 minutes because there really isn't anything to say. Baker's there to win. He's not there to negotiate.
The other thing that's interesting about Baker in the 2000 election is that, you know, this was an extraordinary thing. We forget because it happened, but and we're also because we're living in even more extraordinary times. But the idea that a father-son duo would both have the presidency in a relatively short amount of time, this had never happened except for John Adams and John Quincy Adams at the very beginning of the Republic. So this was a big deal. George W. Bush, then the governor of Texas, was extremely concerned to appear to be his own man and not to be just simply bringing back his father's advisors for a rerun, a reunion show. And so that was part of why Jim Baker and others were kept at arm's length during the 2000 campaign. So it was really even more notable that Baker was the one who was immediately called in when there was a big crisis like the 2000 Florida recount.
The last major role that Baker played in the public sphere that you highlight was his co-chairing of the Iraq Study Group. Around the same time, it's not well remembered, though, that Bush 43 actually wanted to pick Baker as Secretary of Defense to replace Don Rumsfeld. But Baker said absolutely not. He was too old for it. He'd already effectively headed three cabinet departments by being Secretary of State, and before that, Secretary of Treasury, and before that, for a while, the acting Secretary of Commerce. Still, he poured his heart into the Iraq Study Group. He handled this differently, though, than most seemingly independent commissions were handled, didn't he?
Well, he did, absolutely. He saw this as wanting to be constructive for his friend's son, George W. Bush. However, I think both the story of why he didn't become defense secretary and the story of the Iraq Study Group are really about Baker's very ingrained skepticism about the invasion of Iraq that George W. Bush had launched and his deep aversion to military interventionism. That was something that came through in all of Peter and my conversations with Secretary Baker. He is very, very wary of the unrestrained use of American military force as an instrument of power in the world. And he did come out of his tenure at the State Department, I think, really believing in diplomacy first in a way that has obviously not always been at the heart of our international theory of the world over the last couple decades since 9/11. And so he was deeply, deeply wary of the invasion of Iraq. And, you know, most people pay attention to Brent Scowcroft, who had been George H.W. Bush's national security advisor, really ended up in a painful rift with George W. Bush and his advisors over his public criticism of the invasion before it occurred. Baker made many similar points in his own op-ed before the invasion of Iraq, but not in much less stinging terms, and was able to maintain, therefore, his relationships with George W. Bush. But still, he saw the Iraq study group coming at a time when Iraq was perceived as a disaster that was bringing down the presidency, that was destroying American credibility in the region. And he was hopeful that this would actually provide a useful way forward mm-hmm. for George W. Bush. Although, as we know, it wasn't really.
Right. I have to say, across your entire book, you definitely reinforced the themes that Baker was, for what, 25 years, Washington's indispensable man. I think it was Tom Donilon from the other side of the aisle who said that he was the most important unelected official since World War II. And yet, the stories in the book really go back to a few key relationships that Baker had. And I'd like to close by hitting on two of those. First, it's hard to tell the story of Jim Baker without telling the story of his friend George Herbert Walker Bush, as their relationship goes back to the early 1960s at least. And yet, throughout the book, in various positions, in the Reagan White House, in the Bush White House, and beyond, there's some real tension here. It is not always a close friendship that overcomes everything. Sometimes there's some real disagreements and some real anger here. Talk through what you learned about the fascinating and deep relationship between these two men.
Well, they're often compared to brothers. And of course, as anybody who has a brother or has a sister probably knows, that isn't always, you know, sweetness and light. There are moments of rivalry, moments of, you know, anger and siblings fight. And so, yeah, I think that you saw that throughout their relationship. I mean, it was forged in a very powerful way when Jim Baker's first wife dies. And the only person he tells that his first wife is going to die of cancer is his friend George Bush. And the last people who saw Mary Stuart Baker, his first wife, before she passed away outside of her family were George and Barbara Bush. This forges a relationship that's stronger than any typical president and secretary of state have ever had. But throughout the course of their political career together, as well as their personal lives, there are moments of tension. Bush resents it when Baker gets attention for seeming to be the real power behind the throne, the deputy president, the prime mm-hmm. minister, people called him. You know, at various points, Bush would say, if you're so smart, how come you're not president? And that's when Baker knew he had to back off. When Bush made a few famous decisions without consulting Baker, including his choice of Dan Quayle as his running mate,
right,
including his choice of John Sununu as his chief of staff, almost sort of like acts of rebellion against this notion that Baker was somehow first among equals. And we didn't always, that didn't always work out well for him. And then, of course, after the 92 election, there was some bitterness in the Bush family that Baker had been so reluctant to come back and so and had done enough, in particularly in Barbara Bush's view, to salvage the campaign. So that lingering sourness was there for a number of years until Florida came along and he kind of, you know, sort of vindicated himself. But, you know, in the end, we talked to Baker on the day that George Bush died. And he told us the story of the last 24 hours. And it's so powerful. He had been to Bush's house 3 times that day alone. Mm-hmm. And the final time he was there when Bush is passing away. And he's rubbing Bush's feet while Bush is in his deathbed, literally rubbing his feet for a half an hour as his friend is passing away. That's a friendship that is deep and powerful and profound. And sort of unlike any I think we've seen among power players in Washington going back for generations. I can't think of anything quite like it.
Mm-hmm. There's one more real contrast here that in his interactions with someone else really brings out the contrast within Jim Baker himself. On the one side, there's the Jim Baker who is a Republican to the core, even campaigning for Oliver North, of all people, during North's 1994 bid for a seat in the U.S. Senate, something even Ronald Reagan wouldn't do for North. But on the other side of Jim Baker is a pragmatist who's looking out for America's long-term interests. And as you note, Baker driven by desire to bring stability and order above all else. Well, that tension really comes out with how you open and close your book, which is the dilemma of Donald Trump. Talk about that. Talk about Jim Baker's attitude towards this president and how it really brings out that tension within the two sides of his governing philosophy.
Well, that's right. So we started this book quite a long time ago now, in the Obama years. But of course, they ended up being also a period of time with the rise of Trump as a political force. And watching and interacting with Secretary Baker as he struggles to come to terms with Donald Trump, as he recognizes Trump's political staying power. Even late in life, Baker turned 90 this year, he really has a true appreciation of what it takes to win politically and understood, I think, earlier than some Republicans, Trump's appeal in that Republican primary election season back in 2016. We talked with him throughout, and Baker was struggling so manifestly. I remember so vividly sitting down with him in the Willard Hotel barely a week before the 2016 election. And, you know, the Bush family had already said they were not going to be voting for Donald Trump. Of course, Trump had viciously and personally attacked not only Jeb Bush, but both Presidents Bush. And so it would have been an easy out for Jim Baker simply to go along with his friends, the Bushes, and to say, of course, I can't vote for Donald Trump. But he couldn't bring himself to do that in ways that I think Peter and I found both frustrating as biographers, but also revealing ultimately about the person. And Baker, right before the election, was literally in anguish. He said that Trump was nuts. He said he was crazy. He said that he disagreed with basically most of his policy preferences when it came to things like being against free trade or the praise that he lavished on Vladimir Putin. You know, NAFTA was a deal that actually Bush and Baker had first set in motion. So, you know, these were really core principles that Baker disagreed with. And of course, he understood, I think, the flaws in Donald Trump's character. But he just couldn't bring himself to vote against him. And I said, really, you know, you're the un-Trump in so many ways, sir. I said, are you really going to vote for him? And there was just this anguished pause. And he said, well, I haven't done it yet. Mm-hmm. Now, he did. He did vote for Donald Trump in the privacy of the voting booth. He made a distinction between endorsing him or doing anything publicly for him and actually voting for him. But in the end, I think it tells you a lot about both the accommodation of the Republican Party, how they could have accepted this nominee who would seem to be anathema to the party's core beliefs, as they certainly were to Jim Baker, and also to be of such a character as you would never imagine someone like Jim Baker would support. And yet, you know, there is a ruthless view of power politics in which winning is the ultimate justification, in which success is enough. And I do think that, you know, we saw in the course of doing this book that, you know, a party and its ideology are a malleable thing, and they can go in very different directions. Trump's victory wasn't inevitable, but just like some of Baker's great successes as a statesman and as a diplomat, you can't go back in time, and the Republican Party going forward will be forever different because of the choice of people like Jim Baker and others to vote for Trump, even when they didn't like him.
Peter, any closing reflections on Jim Baker in this era that is so unlike the era that he grew up in as a politician and as an operative?
Yeah, I think one of the reasons we wanted to write this book and the reason we call it The Man Who Ran Washington is because it's about the man, but also about Washington. It's a story of, you know, our power and our government and our politics and how they've changed over the last generation. And you can't read this book without thinking about how different things have been and where things are today. It's a very relevant story to today's politics, I think, to think about the changes in our capital and our governance and how they got there. And you can argue that some of the, you know, seeds of today were planted during the, you know, the era in which Baker was ascendant. You could point back to various moments and say, well, that's the beginning of something we would see, you know, blown out in a bigger way come 2016 and 2020. So I think that's one of the reasons why Baker's story is so relevant and so powerful and so important today, because it tells us about ourselves, it tells us about our country, and it tells us about our time.
Well, with that, let me thank you both for a masterful book, not only giving us a window into Jim Baker and his life and career, but also, as you say, giving us a different perspective on the political and governance aspects of American government in the last 50 years. Thanks for discussing it with me today. I appreciate it.
David, thank you so much for your interest in this, and to all your listeners. As I said, we're big fans of Lawfare, and we're grateful that you all exist at this moment in time.
Hey, we appreciate that.
Really enjoy the conversation.
Thanks a lot. The Lawfare podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. If you've listened this far and you're still with us, please take one additional minute to rate the podcast or let someone know about the podcast so they can enjoy it too. This episode is edited and produced by Jen Pacha-Howell. Zachary Frank of Goat Rodeo is our audio engineer, and Sophia Yan performed our music. As always, thanks for listening.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.